Irene Craigle. I'm the director of the Center for Counseling and Wellness, which is a student counseling center at Calvin College, way up north in Grand Rapids, and I'm happy to be with you all here today. From the size of this room, it looks like there may be some anxiety going on in your schools. So I'm glad you're here. I'm looking forward to exploring this topic with you today. I tend to try to pack too much into every presentation that I give, so I'm going to try to talk fast. Don't hesitate to raise your hand, ask a question along the way, and if we're lucky, I'll have a little time at the end for question and answer, too. I'm also happy to stick around afterwards. So in terms of my training, I'm a psychologist. I've been a clinical psychologist for the past 18 years. Done a lot of work in the therapy room with children, adolescents, adults who have anxiety, depression, lots of other concerns going on. And then I've been working in the college setting at Calvin College for the last 10 years, currently in the director role there. We see a lot of anxiety among college students. And we are actually thrilled that in the last even 3 to 4 years, there has been a very clear reduction in stigma for college students who are coming into that setting saying, I would like support around my anxiety. And I attribute that very much to the good work that's being done with those kids all the way through up until college, because students are now coming in knowing what anxiety is, knowing how to recognize some of the symptoms for themselves, and ready to seek treatment. So, some great stigma reduction has been going on in those middle and high school levels. So what I hope to do today in a bit of a whirlwind over the next hour is to introduce you to some basic concepts about anxiety, give you a little bit of a framework to use in thinking about anxiety with students and with ourselves, and then talk about some really practical steps and strategies you might take as you're thinking about your own work. So let's start right in by just talking about what are some of the different types of anxiety disorders that show up. So here we're thinking a bit diagnostically. You can put on the clinical hats for a moment. So these are categories within the DSM-5, which is kind of the Bible of anxiety and other mental disorders. So we have generalized anxiety disorder, which is when somebody is experiencing a lot of heightened anxiety about a lot of different areas. That are impacting their functioning, making it hard to get through a day. We have social anxiety disorder, which is specifically about interactions or performance. So a room like this can be very triggering for many of us, but particularly if somebody's experiencing social anxiety disorder, that can be quite overwhelming and incapacitating. This one is not uncommon to see show up in the school setting, which is a very social, performance-oriented setting. When we talk about test anxiety or performance anxiety, typically those fall in this category diagnostically. We have panic disorder. So this is when a person is experiencing bouts of anxiety that are incredibly intense for short amounts of time, and it's expressed very physiologically. So we see racing heart rate, sweating, really symptoms that often look like a heart attack, which is why oftentimes somebody experiencing a panic attack may end up in the emergency room to get checked out. Post-traumatic stress disorder is anxiety that's specifically in response to a type of trauma or exposure to a trauma, a lot of fear and triggering around a particular type of dangerous event. And then we have obsessive-compulsive disorder, and this can, all of these can show up at any age, but sometimes we see this with kids coming up in terms of very rigid behaviors, things needing to be a very particular way, with some compulsive and obsessive types of behaviors and thoughts around that. I'm not going to spend a lot of time on this stuff, but just so you know, anxiety really is considered to be the number one mental health issue in America today. In the college setting, we're estimating that at least like 40% of our students are experiencing pretty intense anxiety. When we look at the statistics for different age groups, just a heads up, it really depends on which study you look at and how they're defining it and how they're thinking about it. But some generalizations: about 1 in 8 children would be considered to have an anxiety disorder. About 1 in 3 adolescents would be considered to have an anxiety disorder. And then when you look at adults, we're estimating about 1 in 5. But what I want you to remember, if you don't remember anything else that I just said, is that all of us have anxiety. So anxiety is the human condition. So all those stats I just threw at you, that's us trying to get a sense of control around it, right? To sort of try to understand to some extent What are the boundaries that we're working within here in terms of intensity, impact on functioning? But there is not a living, breathing human being that does not experience anxiety of some sort, pretty much on a daily basis. So if you think about basic stress, it is oftentimes stress. Let me modify that. It's pretty much always stress that to some extent is involved in any kind of success, any kind of growth, any kind of movement, any kind of survival in the world. We actually are given a certain level of stress and anxiety by God to survive and to reach our goals. So what that means is that anxiety is not the enemy. And a lot of good anxiety treatment and also anxiety support in the classroom and in other settings has to do with learning to see anxiety in more neutral terms as opposed to a problem. Now, don't be alarmed. I'm not saying we have to like it. Nobody enjoys being anxious. We're simply saying we can have a different type of relationship with anxiety than one of panic and fear and anxiety about the anxiety, which can help in the long run. So we'll go more into that as we go along. So when we're thinking about anxiety, here's sort of a general dictionary definition. We're talking about a feeling of worry, nervousness, unease, typically about an imminent event or something with an uncertain outcome. Who in this room has not felt any worry, nervousness, or unease in the last 12 months? Nobody, right? And what is life if not something that has an uncertain outcome, right? So this is something that we live with day to day. So just quickly before we go on, I would love to hear from you, a few of you, about what are you seeing in students when they are feeling anxious. So how do you know that a particular student in your sphere of care is feeling anxious? Can you volunteer? Yeah.
They might chew their clothes.
Yeah, so chewing clothes she's describing, whether it's a sleeve or a shirt.
Hair pulling or just general shutdown behavior.
Yeah, hair pulling, shutdown behavior, absolutely. What else?
Some kids look really deer in the headlights, like huge eyes looking around really quick, like I don't know what to do.
Yeah. Deer in the headlights, big eyes looking around, sort of not sure what to do.
Crying,
yeah, so that emotion being expressed that way. Mm-hmm. Any others?
Stomach aches,
right, that somatic expression happens sometimes. Absolutely. So here are a couple examples that I thought of. So we have this sort of avoidant, like not looking at the teacher response sometimes, right, like not me. You see the sweating going on in this individual as well. We have the classic Calvin. My 7-year-old was so excited I put this up here for you, so just appreciate it for him. So kind of the, sometimes we see behaviors that cover up anxiety for a student. We might think that they're just angry or acting out, and really there's some anxiety underneath. Anyone have a Calvin in their classroom? So, yeah. Sometimes we see isolation. So sometimes we call it shyness or just kind of pulling away, not connecting with other students. That's particularly if that anxiety has a social component to it. We might see some clowning, like the class clown type of behavior, acting out, trying to get attention. I don't know about in your settings, but perfectionism is one of the main ways we see anxiety in a college setting. Students trying so hard to get every single thing right. So if you think back to that definition of anxiety as having to do with that uncertain outcome, trying to make everything as certain as possible would be one approach. We can also think about that in terms of maybe overachieving. And then we have some students who kind of check out and underachieve intentionally out of anxiety as well. All of these things can be summed up with this word. You like how I made that word twist? I felt good about that. Avoidance. All of these things I just described to you are different types of avoidance. And this is at the heart of how we want to think about approaching anxiety in ourselves and with others. Avoidance is the result of anxiety, and avoidance also feeds anxiety. So when we are working to lessen the impact of anxiety on ourselves or others, one of the key principles to keep in mind is to learn to turn towards the anxiety, to turn towards the things that we're afraid of, to recognize that anxiety is not our enemy. Now, I can get really philosophical and psychological and go into how really no feelings are the enemy. And so feelings, I think one of the disservices that the field of psychology has done for the world is to start to define emotions as problems. To say that if you have an emotion that's uncomfortable, it's probably a warning sign of something bad and you better go talk to a professional about it. I'm all for talking to professionals, and you will hear me encouraging you to send children to therapists, send children to professional help along the way when that's going to be a useful step. But sometimes we forget to start at that basic point of, oh, there's fear here. Yeah, life is kind of scary. Let's sit with that for a little bit and be present to that before we rush to define it as a problem and fix it. So the very first step in any effective work with a child who's feeling anxious is to help them turn towards that anxiety. So here we see this this character has all that in their mind. That's often how anxiety feels, right? Lots and lots of thoughts, swirling. And this character is learning to turn towards himself, herself, with curiosity. I kind of like the look on that little character's face, right? Sort of like, oh, hi. It's anxiety. Hello, anxiety. So let's talk specifically about what in the world that means. I'm going to try to be as practical as possible because I know I love to walk out of a session with some practical tips. But along the way, we'll be weaving in some of these philosophical themes I've just talked about. And hopefully you'll see those show up. So the very first thing you want to think about is making sure that both you and the individual that you're working with or supporting has some basic sense about what's going on with anxiety. One of the natures of anxiety is that it tends to feel very vague. So usually when we're anxious, there's not a lot of specificity in our thinking about it. It's sort of these kind of vague what if these bad things happen. And so one really helpful step is just to take a step back and think about what's going on in the brain. So some of you may have this information already. I'll just give a quick rundown of the basics of how anxiety works in the brain, partially because this is really helpful stuff for kids and teenagers to know what's happening in their own brain, what's happening in all of our brains when we feel anxious. So we have the center part of our brain. You can see it labeled there, the amygdala, and that hippocampus is right by the amygdala. The amygdala is sort of the emotional center of our brain. It's where the emotions fire off when we're feeling anxious. Not just when we're feeling anxious, any emotions, but here we're talking about anxiety. I should mention, too, I'm happy to share these slides. I didn't have it together, and I didn't get them on your site ahead of time, but I'm happy to get those out in whatever way works for the conference. But feel free to take pictures, too, if that's your preferred mode of capturing it. So when we experience some type of trigger, and a trigger doesn't have to be a rational trigger, doesn't have to be something that's expected to start anxiety. But something triggers an emotional response in the brain. It comes out of that amygdala. That is a completely unconscious response. We have absolutely no control over whether we feel that fear that comes out of that emotional center of the brain. The hippocampus, as you may know, is in charge of storing memories over time. So right away as educators, you're probably picking up on this connection then between emotion and learning. This is one of the reasons we care about this as educators, is that your students will learn better when those emotions are calmed, because that hippocampus is less able to store information over time if anxiety is really heightened. Now, this prefrontal cortex, you'll see it's right there in our forehead, in the top front of the brain. That's kind of the executor, sort of like the logical, rational, planning, organizing part of the brain that is good at calming us down. We do have conscious control over that prefrontal cortex. We can influence the engagement of our prefrontal cortex, even though we can't influence whether that amygdala fires off or not. Sometimes we can be going through a day and suddenly an emotion just hits us out of the blue. We like to call that an amygdala hijack sometimes. We have no control over whether that happens or not. right? So maybe you're standing in front of a classroom and suddenly it's like, whoa, my heart rate hit down there. What happened, right? Or maybe you see somebody that reminds you of somebody that you don't particularly want to see and you kind of go, whoa, strong emotion happening right there. That's an amygdala hijack. So when a kid is experiencing really intense anxiety, that's what's happening for them. That amygdala is getting fired off. And we talk about the fight, flight, or freeze response being part of what comes out of that process. So I won't go too much into the biology of all that. But it's a very real physical reaction that happens, especially when we're scared. Now, one of you mentioned that kind of deer in the headlights look that can happen when somebody's really anxious. We would think about that as a freeze response. So we're afraid, we just sort of freeze, you know, or it's kind of, sometimes it's kind of like a turtle response, just sort of trying to hide out. For some students, it might be that they're anxious and they start to get really worked up and kind of aggressive and picking on others and irritable, and we would think of that more as a fight response, sort of going into defensive mode. And then for some, it's that flee response, which is more, I gotta get out of here. I took my son to the dentist a few days ago because he had this tooth thing going on. And the dentist walked out of the room and my son started to try to get the dentist bib off, you know, and he was like, we gotta get out of here. And I'm like, no, we don't, right? There's nothing dangerous, but his anxiety was kicking in. He wanted to flee that situation. So we all sort of have our favorite response. You know, maybe you're more of a fighter or a fleer or a freezer, but it's helpful for all of us to know what our kind of what our stress signature is, and it's helpful for your students to know what their stress signature is. Now, the goal of most anxiety responses is going to be to try to engage that prefrontal cortex. So you think about the amygdala being the emotional center of the brain. We want to be able to activate that prefrontal cortex to be able to intercept the fight, flight, or freeze response and bring some calm to the brain. Now, when I say intercept, I don't mean avoid it or not have it, because remember, that's not an option for us. That's just kind of a survival instinct that kicks in. But we want to learn and teach strategies for pausing and stepping back long enough to engage the prefrontal cortex to be able to bring some calm over time. So as we go along, that you can keep that framework in mind. Here's a really kind of fun, simple way to talk to students about it or to each other about it. So if you can all put up your hand for a second. And you're going to think about your thumb as the amygdala, that emotional center of the brain. So we're going to fold that over the middle of the hand right there. That's right in the center then of the brain. If you can do that, it's hard for me. And then you're going to think of these fingers up here as your prefrontal cortex. So you can kind of fold those over. So you see the prefrontal cortex is creating a bit of a protection, a barrier in this model for that amygdala in the center. We can imagine this being a spinal cord down here, which is connecting the brain to the whole body, which is why anxiety really impacts all of who we are, physically even. Now, when we're feeling upset, this is a model taught by Dan Siegel, who's an interpersonal biologist. He talks about us flipping our lid, so flip your fingers up for a minute. So your prefrontal cortex is offline at this point, and the amygdala is wide open, running the show there. We want to teach students how to re-engage that prefrontal cortex, right? You can put your hands down. Good job. Sometimes for kids, just having that simple physical demonstration is going to help. I just was hearing it last week about a kid who was telling his mom in a moment of frustration, Mom, I'm right here. I'm right here. Right? So they called it the claw after that, right? So, but for kids to kind of know, like, how much is that prefrontal cortex engaged right now? And how much am I acting out of that fight, flight, or freeze response? It's coming out of that amygdala in the middle of my brain. Now, remembering, again, that all of us experience anxiety, so one of the things to keep in mind when you're having these conversations with students is that it can be really helpful to acknowledge that. So that silly little thing we just did with our hands, that's for all of us, right? And students can be really empowered when they hear the adults in their life talking about their own experiences with that, too. I don't know how many of you are familiar with the work of Brené Brown. Anybody know Brené Brown? She's pretty awesome. I got to see her live last week. I'm so excited. But if you don't know the work of Brené Brown, look her up. She has two TED Talks that are really incredible. B-R-E-N-E is her first name, Brené Brown. She talks a lot about vulnerability, the power of vulnerability to create community and reduce shame, and thereby decreasing suffering. And I think the reason that her work is becoming so popular is because we're losing sight of that a bit in this particular cultural context in this particular time in history. And so you can be an agent of change for the students you work with by being honest about life being tough. That we all get scared, we all have anxiety, we all have stress, and hey, this is how we are coming together to deal with this. So my brain is the same too, right? This is something that happens for all of us. So when you're thinking with students then about their brains, right, wanting to help them re-engage that prefrontal cortex, here's some of the really specific strategies that you might consider using with them for that re-engagement process. And sometimes this is talked about in terms of this, what is this called? Is this an acrostic? Is that the right word? Is it an acronym? Stop. Okay, so we're using this acronym, STOP. What is an acrostic? That's like a bone thing, right?
Yeah.
Okay, thank you. I learned something. Okay, so the very first part of this, STOP, is stop. And so you want to think about this as an opportunity to pause. Now, you cannot overestimate the power of the pause. Because so much of what we do in life is just one thing to the next, to the next, to the next. I was just in a therapy session this morning with a student who said, I feel like a machine. Like I get up in the morning and I go straight to breakfast and straight to class and then I study and then I get lunch and then I go to practice and then I have this extracurricular and then I study till I collapse into bed and I sleep and I get up and do it all over again. And that's not just college students who are dealing with that kind of pressure. It's us, it's young children these days. So the power of pausing to notice what's going on is really, really important. So you want to teach students first and foremost to pause. And even if we think back to what's going on in the brain, recognizing that that amygdala is firing off that center of the brain, and sort of if we don't pause to re-engage the prefrontal cortex, we're not stopping that process. We're not intervening in that process. So first of all, just pausing. And then in the pause, taking a breath. That's the T, take a breath. You can approach this in a lot of different ways. The challenge with suggesting using a breath as a way to manage anxiety is that it sounds way too simple. So most people are like, okay, yeah, what else do you got for me? Because I'm already breathing all day, right? And that doesn't seem to be helping. So you want to be ready for a little resistance around this one and ready to sit with people while they practice a few different approaches to breathing. So let's all together as a group right now, just for a moment, we're going to do 3 deep breaths today, just for fun. So go ahead and take 3 slow deep breaths on your own. Very simple technique to use with a child is simply to pause and take 3 deep breaths. Now you may need 5 deep breaths, you may need 10 deep breaths. For some, it's not so much breathing deeply, it's just paying attention to the breath for a little while. There are all kinds of fancy breathing techniques out there. There's square breathing and 4 square breathing and 5-7 breathing, and there are a lot of different ways to count it. If you have a favorite, feel free to use that with your students. If your student has a favorite, go with that one. But the important thing is some awareness of the breath. I truly believe that God has built into our very bodies the skills we need for coping, the things we need to calm ourselves down. And the problem is not that we have gone all haywire and don't have ways to calm ourselves down. The problem is we've stopped noticing them. The breath is this built-in calming mechanism that God has given us. So we kind of want to help students remove some of the barriers to experiencing that breathing as a calming thing. Sometimes for kids it's especially helpful to be as concrete and black and white about this as possible, and one of the ways to do that is to have them put their hand on their belly. In the world of mindfulness, which is one of the tools we teach for anxiety management with kids and adults, Sometimes with kids, we have them put a stuffed animal on their belly as they're laying on the ground, and then they can feel that animal going up and down, or kind of watch that animal going up and down. I've done it even with little cotton balls with kids before. But sometimes just that act of having their hand on their belly, sometimes putting their hand on their belly and kind of going out and in with the hands as they breathe, bless you. That can be another concrete way to connect in with the breath. But something that tunes them into their breath, that's going to be step two. Step three is to observe. Now, I told you about the prefrontal cortex being about logic and organization and executive functioning. Part of what the prefrontal cortex does is it labels stuff. So as soon as you or the person you're working with starts to put labels on your experience, you are engaging the prefrontal cortex. So this is why something as simple as sitting down with somebody and saying, I feel this emotion. I feel sad, or I feel worried, or stressed, or angry. That simple act of labeling the emotion is starting to shift the brain in a different direction. It helps to put those labels on. So for some students, it might help to write that down. For some students, it might help to say it out loud. For others, some of you may have seen different thermometers that can be colored in to show different levels of emotion or different types of emotion. There are all kinds of cool emoji things out there that can help students identify that. So maybe a poster on your wall with emojis or something that they can point to online. But just that act of labeling their emotion is actually part of the process of shifting the brain's reaction to anxiety. Another way to observe, so we're first talking about observing the emotion, what they're experiencing. Another way to engage that prefrontal cortex is to observe what's around them. So we often talk about just using the five senses. I know we can say there are more than five too, but we go with five with kids. So sometimes we call it a 5x5. So for each of the five senses, what are five things you can observe? So let's just do that. So for a minute, just kind of notice five things you can observe with your sense of sight. So you can be thinking about colors and shapes, putting some labels. And then five things you can observe with your sense of touch. So it might be clothing on the skin, air on the skin, the chair you're sitting on, or the floor you're sitting on. Maybe the feeling on the top of your scalp where the hair touches, the air touches. And then five things you can observe in terms of hearing. Notice if you're able to identify five different sounds. That one's a little harder, right? And then a little even more challenging in this setting would be taste and smell. So maybe notice what you can taste. Notice what you can smell. Now if you're doing this with a child where you're really working to calm that anxiety, you might actually have five different things for them to taste or five different things for them to smell. Things like lotions or essential oils or soaps can actually be nice ways of calming the brain just by engaging, helping them to observe something that they're smelling. So observation, that's the O. So we have stop, take a breath, observe, and then proceed. And this is one of the important points I want you to hear about anxiety, is that it is rarely helpful to allow kids not to do things because they are anxious. So there will be situations where it makes sense to maybe make some accommodations or modify things to make sure that you're helping them work at a step that they're ready for. But to completely step out of an activity because of anxiety tends to reinforce the anxiety. So what that tells the brain is, yes, that really was a dangerous thing, and the only reason this horrible thing hasn't happened to me is because I got out of it, right? So the brain needs to learn over time that they can engage in that activity and feel anxiety, and then once they're through it, the anxiety comes back down. We all know that there are many things we do in life that are important and worthwhile and anxiety-provoking. So I know when I'm standing in this room talking to all of you, I have a different level of stress than when I'm sitting on my couch at home in my pajamas eating bonbons, right? So it's physiologically, it's a different experience. I enjoy this. I actually love talking to all of you. This is fun for me. It's a meaningful part of my job. If I wasn't willing to be here with some of that stress, it wouldn't happen, right? I have to be willing to be a little bit anxious to do this kind of presentation. That's why you want to teach kids, that you go into things that matter with your anxiety. It's kind of like a friend you bring along. Like, hey, anxiety, let's go do that presentation together, right? And so, again, you need to step that for kids. So it's just like any other subject matter you might be teaching, you figure out where are they in terms of their level and what are they able to do and how can I support them in learning that next step. But teaching them that, yes, you proceed on with the task at hand, allowing whatever those feelings are to be present in the process. Now, let me talk a little bit about mindfulness. So mindfulness is something I am really passionate about in terms of anxiety management, but also treating depression. And really just supporting overall life satisfaction. And also, I think as Christians, we have this opportunity to use mindfulness as a way to deepen our spiritual walk, our relationship with God, too. So many benefits to this practice. I had this video to show you, but I hear the sound isn't really working in here, so I'm going to skip it. But you can Google this. This is Susan Kaiser Greenland. So Susan, then the next name is K-A-I-S-E-R. And her last name is Greenland. And she has this video called The Seeing Clearly Game. It's just on YouTube. You can find it. So I'll just explain to you what you will see in the video. But Susan uses this ball that has glitter in it, the kind you shake up, and it gets all cloudy in there from the glitter. And uses that as a demonstration of how it takes some time to pause and watch and breathe before things can clear. And this is true in this little ball of glitter, and it's also true in our minds. Another really useful analogy or metaphor to use with kids, and I know it's actually become somewhat popular to help kids make glitter jars where they can do this for themselves. Has anyone done this with kids before? Yeah. So they can get pretty into it. It's kind of mesmerizing to shake up that glitter. I think you have to put glue in it, right? Okay. Yeah. But then the glitter kind of slowly comes down, and kids can watch that as one way to calm their minds as they watch that glitter in the jar calming. This is what mindfulness is about. So mindfulness, literally defined, is a process of paying attention to the present moment without judgment. So you're bringing your awareness fully to the present, and doing that with this attitude of non-judgment, curiosity, acceptance of what you find there. Very simple definition, very challenging practice. So our minds are very rarely in the present moment. That's just a natural way that our brains work. So with mindfulness, we are learning to come back over and over and over to what's right here. Most of the things that we're anxious about are not right here, right? They're in the future, or they're things in the past that we're ruminating about. So kids can learn this practice of over and over noticing, where did my mind go? Oh, I'm thinking about something down the road, or I'm thinking about something that happened in the past. I don't have control over either of those. Let me come back to right here, which does then empower us to plan more effectively for the future and also to process the past more effectively. But to live in this only space that we have any control, which is right here, right now, in this moment. This app, Stop, Breathe, and Think, is one that's a favorite in my household. They have a kids version and an adults version of it. It has some really nice mindfulness practices that kids can do totally on their own. And one of the reasons I'm featuring them for you is because they have a whole free package of resources for educators. So any teacher can sign up for the premium package of Stop, Breathe, and Think at no cost, which is pretty awesome. My son is super jealous of all of you in this room. But the meditations for kids are fun. They're accessible. The program is very secular-based. It doesn't really bring any spirituality into the meditations. Certainly, my experience with mindfulness practice is that for people who choose to integrate Christianity into that practice, they're very compatible in that way. But this app will just bring it to you without any of that integration. If you wanted some particular resources about mindfulness, here are a few ideas. So mindful schools and mindfulness in schools are two programs that are created specifically for teachers who want to bring mindfulness into the classroom. Both of these programs have training programs really around the world, but certainly throughout the United States. Some of them more expensive than others, but even those websites have some pretty good resources on them. If you happen to be in the Grand Rapids area, there's also a group in Grand Rapids called Mindful Moments in Education, and they do some really great teacher training, so I just thought I would give them a shout out. And then there's a blog website called Mindful Teachers that just has a lot of resources and connections to different online things that might be helpful for you if you wanted to learn more. My typical warning about mindfulness is that you really can't teach it unless you're using it. It's, I would say, maybe very similar to trying to teach, let's say, Christian faith, right? So I would want, if my child is receiving instruction in terms of faith, I would hope that would be from someone who's living that out, who's on that path. Mindfulness has this element of if you're, you can't really just tell somebody else, like, well, just pay attention to the present moment, right? It has to be something that you have lived, that you have practiced, that you have worked on yourself. So if this is something that's of interest to you, I would explore some of that training for yourself. I have found in my own life mindfulness to be incredibly liberating and healing, and really a path that God has used to bring a lot of healing for me. So I teach it in the Calvin College setting, and students love it. It's very helpful. So the other thing I would just mention is that we have a big influence on students based on the environments that we're creating for them. And so I'm calling this the container. So there's this concept, I think you say hygge, the Danish word. And the idea is that we have the capacity to create these environments that are calming. And particularly for those of us who live in the Midwest and have long winters and it gets cloudy and icky, the approach of being intentional about creating spaces that are comforting and calm really goes a long way in terms of our mental wellness through the winter, but really year-round. And when I think about students with anxiety, part of what their own internal experience is so mixed up and overwhelmed and disorganized that really they're looking for those structures that will provide them with a sense of calm. So I would really look at the spaces that you're creating for students with that in mind. Again, knowing all of us experience anxiety. And so thinking for a student who's walking into a classroom or an educational space with some heightened anxiety, what in that environment would bring a sense of calm? So are there calm colors? Are there plants? Is the lighting conducive to maybe being turned down a couple notches? Are there comfortable places to sit? I know the couch in my son's classroom is like the hot spot, right? Everyone wants to sit on the couch. I think that's because it sort of speaks about like a homey, comfortable place. So thinking about ways to create that in the environment. I put that website up there because it has some good ideas about that. And knowing that that calm space really starts with you. And so we know more and more as more research is done over time that so much of our well-being is tied to each other. And some of that is the words that we say. I mean, a lot of it is the words that we say, the ways that we act. But there's also just this sense that you can get in people's presence about how they're doing, right? People don't usually have to say a lot for you to have a basic sense of how they're doing. That puts a lot of pressure on us, I know, as people who are working with students. But I'm very aware that at a counseling center, the space that I'm creating with my own persona in a room has a pretty big impact on clients. Clients who come into our counseling center and who come into my office will often say, "It's so calm here." And you can just see they're absorbing a little bit of that calm. So we want to think about how do we manage our own emotions, not in a fake calm way, right? But doing that real work of managing our own emotions. And how do we manage our space in a way that's inviting calm so we can invite those students right into that calm for us. So, I had another video I was going to show you. And without these two videos, my present, I'm going to tell you how to find this one because I love this video. I want you to watch it. It's called Just Breathe. And if you, it's on YouTube. It's put out by Mindful Schools. But if you just Google Just Breathe, the creators of the video are Salzman, S-A-L-Z-M-A-N, and Salzman, actually. Same last name. That's a good one to look up. So this video is going to show you some kids talking about mindfulness and about breathing and about managing heightened emotions. They're mostly going to be talking about anger, but as we talked about at the beginning, sometimes kids are showing their anxiety through anger. So you'll get to see them kind of explaining that process of learning to pause, to step back, to observe their emotions and breathe, and finding that that opens up a whole other kind of space. All right, so without those two emotions, my presentation is shorter than it was going to be otherwise. So let's do some Q&A. I would love to hear what are you wondering in reaction to what I've said, or just what's going on in your classrooms, and how can I be of support?
Yeah. So teach students, educate them. What do you do in a situation when they start using it as a question or as an excuse?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so the question is, what do you do if a student starts to use anxiety as a crutch or an excuse? So we work with this in the college setting quite a bit. Where students sometimes are saying, my professors just don't understand. I can't get the class because I have anxiety and depression. Or I can't get my homework done. I shouldn't be required to take that exam because I have this condition. So these are tough waters to navigate. So let me throw out a couple thoughts. So first of all, we want to approach any emotional distress, including anxiety, with empathy. So let me just kind of make that our framework, right? The foundation of this is this reality of shared suffering. Sometimes in the world of mental health, we call this common humanity. So when a student comes to you with intense anxiety, the foundation of your discussion should be, yes, this is really hard. This is very hard. It's okay that you're having a hard time. Having said that, coming back to what I said about avoidance. So remembering that when we want to help students avoid avoiding, because once we start avoiding out of our anxiety, that really feeds the anxiety. So even if you're putting their educational goals aside, if you just think clinically what's helpful for their anxiety, avoiding will not be helpful for their anxiety in the long run. You want to help students engage. So if your sense is that a student is out of their anxiety, trying to step out of a lot of things, it's helpful to talk to them about that, right? And this is where you may want to think about, I don't know what that noise is. This is where you may want to think about engaging a mental health professional as well, because that can be really helpful for those conversations. Sometimes a mental health professional may have a little more grounds to say, you know, let's think about what's going to be helpful for your anxiety in particular and be part of that consultation. I love it when professors call me with those types of questions. But working with a student on thinking about how can we actually help you live to your fullest potential with this anxiety. So again, this is in the context of empathy and support, acknowledging this is really hard. So we're working on something very challenging. You don't want to be giving the message that you're just using this to get out of this, right? You want to be giving the message of, yeah, this is tough. So let's work together on moving you forward. And then you want to be thinking about how do you help the student build those coping skills that will help them to stay engaged. So is it an exam that they're trying to get out of, or a test or a quiz they don't want to take? Thinking with them about what are the specific anxieties about that test and how can you help them break that down to be able to take that test? Or is it a particular social situation they are afraid of? What specifically are they afraid of? How can you be helping them to build some coping skills around that. So that would be my recommendation. Other questions? Yeah?
How do you determine a step from this is anxiety that we can address in the classroom with the teacher, helping teach some of these things, to needing some professional help?
Yeah, so the question is, how do you determine if this is something you can work on in the classroom with a teacher or if professional help should be recommended? I am a believer in starting with the lowest intervention you think might be helpful. And so I think you make that determination as you try the lower steps. See what works, see what doesn't. If you hit a point where it's not working anymore and you kind of feel like you're out of resources, that's a great time to call in a professional or make that recommendation. You know, I think in our culture we've started talking a lot more about depression and anxiety than we have about sadness and fear. And depression and anxiety are sort of like, quick, go talk to a counselor about this one. And sadness and fear are more like, oh yeah, we all got that, right? And I think to start with the sadness and fear conversation always makes sense, especially if you're talking to kids, right? So the less we can pathologize their emotions, the better. And so if you're talking with them about their sadness and fear, keeping it human, keeping it real, using those interventions you know how to use in the classroom. And if it seems like it's just not getting better or it's escalating or you need some other consultation or they need that support, don't hesitate to reach out for that.
Yeah. What advice would you have for a student who's already seeing outside counselor and frequently hyperventilates in the classroom and makes a big scene on a regular basis?
Yeah. So a student who's seeing a counselor outside, but in the classroom is regularly hyperventilating, there's sort of a big scene around it. Yeah, that's a great question because part of what we find is that attention plays a really interesting role with any kind of emotional distress. And it's not always the same role. So for some students, they're sort of terrified of attention around their distress. And for other students, there seems to be something about the attention that feeds it. And for some students, it's both. They seem terrified, but also somehow that seems to be feeding it. And so remembering that none of those are necessarily bad. So we all, to some extent, have a complicated relationship with attention. You know, we all kind of want attention, but for the right things. And we're all, even the word manipulation, sometimes we talk about kids manipulating things to get certain kinds of attention. I always say we all manipulate, it's just some of us are better at it than others, right? So we're wanting students to learn to manipulate more effectively, but they're doing that in ways that are problematic. So with anxiety, if you find that a student's behavior is drawing a lot of attention, sometimes you're going to look at the situation and say, I think that this attention itself is part of what's feeding this experience, that there's some inherent reward in having a disruption in the classroom or having lots of eyes or lots of attention around that. And so you want to think really like a behavioral psychologist in those situations, which means noticing, okay, what is the reward for the behavior? And really anything can be a reward. So thinking about, are there ways to adjust that reward system? Now, in that type of situation, it might mean that when a student's experiencing that kind of distress, that they step out of the classroom. That's complicated because for other students that would be a reward, right? So this is where your detective hat has to be on. But noticing if it's the attention itself, do they need to be removed from the classroom so that reward isn't there? Or is there some other way that they can be kind of pulled aside, or maybe it's that cozy corner kind of idea that we saw in the picture before. A place where they can go and de-escalate. The other thing I'm thinking is, are there ways to help the student catch it earlier? Because the earlier we catch anxiety or anxious thoughts, the more effective we can be in intercepting that amygdala hijack that happens, so activating the prefrontal cortex. You can also think about, are there ways in the classroom that are less disruptive to help the student engage that prefrontal cortex? So can they pull out a piece of paper as they hyperventilate and start to write down, these are my thoughts, these are my feelings, these are my physical experiences right now. Even creating a chart with columns for students can be helpful, just to say thoughts, feelings, physical experiences. Sometimes we do one for behaviors or urges. And so helping the student to engage that. Ultimately, in those types of situations, when we're at that level of kind of full hyperventilating, if somebody already has a therapist, it's great to engage that person in the conversation too, because they're going to have some expert insight into that particular student. So, yeah, tough situations. Yeah?
Do you have any tips or suggestions for children who would show their anxiety through a tic, whether it's
verbal or noises or physically?
Yeah. So tics, as you probably know, aren't extremely uncommon with children. Most kids do grow out of them over time. Tics really are, by definition, outside of their conscious awareness. So it's not so much that they're completely outside of their control, it's more that they're happening without them really noticing or being aware, and so it's hard to engage that conscious control. You know, although I am not up to date on the latest research about tics, so just a disclaimer about that, but my understanding is that typically we're, it helps to focus with kids on what some of the precipitators are for a tic. So there are times that can come out of heightened anxiety or emotion, and the tic is kind of a response to that. So if a child is able to start to notice that rising emotion or intensity, then it can help them to learn some opposing types of behaviors. So doing something opposite to what the tic is. But a lot of tics are going to kind of just work themselves out. So when a tic isn't particularly disruptive, then it's okay to just kind of let it be and watch it over time, and most of them are going to go away on their own. So.
So as educators, we can't diagnose a student with a certain kind of anxiety like at the beginning. Parent-teacher conferences are coming up, and what would be a valuable resource for teachers to be able to say, I'm observing these specific behaviors in your child, and you're in conferences. I would encourage you to, I'm seeing these behaviors. As parents, this is a suggestion of next steps in regards. Do they go to a pediatrician first to say, what is this? How do you engage? Are there suggestions you have of having that conversation with parents? And number two, when you're listing those behaviors, you know, can we start identifying better what could be the next steps in the parent things like that?
Yeah, so asking about knowing that you're not going to diagnose a mental health condition, if you're in a parent-teacher conference or having a conversation with a parent, how do you present concerns and recommendations around that? So I think starting with that disclaimer, right? So I'm not a mental health professional. I think the more you can use very specific descriptors of behaviors, the better. Many of you know parents can occasionally be a little defensive about what's going on with their child. Now, some of them may actually just be relieved that you're also picking up on something and they're as a team player with them, but some of them, it may feel a bit threatening to bring up some of those concerns. First of all, using that good old sandwich technique where you're starting with positive and then you're sharing concerns and then you're ending with positive. That's going to help with that a bit. But knowing that as you're describing your concerns, be as clear as you can about behaviors. And do that in a compassionate and caring manner. So that goes a long way when you're talking with a parent, is to show that this is out of a place of care for your child. This isn't an attempt to diagnose them or label them or get them out of your classroom. Assuming it's not, but that really your goal is to support their child in being as successful as possible. And then don't pretend you know more than you do, but you know a lot. I mean, you actually are spending hours, for the most part, with these children. I know as a parent, I kind of covet the teacher's observations about my child, right? Like, what have you seen? And so bring that almost as a gift to the parent. Like, these are the things as I've worked with your child and gotten to know them that I've seen. These are ways that they're coping with that well. Here are ways that I see them struggling. And I wouldn't be afraid to refer for a professional assessment if you think that might be helpful. We talk a lot in the field of mental health about motivational interviewing. Anybody here have any training in motivational interviewing or reading about it, some exposure to it? Yeah. It's a good thing to look up. The whole idea is that you are motivating people by helping them focus on what is their own goal. And you especially want to think about relational goals. And along the way, noticing what is the next step that they might be ready for. So when you're talking to a parent, maybe they're not ready to say, yeah, I'll take my child for a psychological assessment with a therapist. That might be terrifying for them. And maybe they are there, in which case, great, go with that. But if not, maybe the step they're ready for is to start to consider maybe talking to their pediatrician, was an example that was just brought up. Sometimes going to the pediatrician sounds less scary than going to a therapist or going to a psychiatrist or something like that. So you kind of want to feel out what do they feel ready for. talking to a doctor can always be a place to start. Doctors have some basic training in mental health conditions and often know good referral sources in that area. If parents seem ready to seek out a therapist or a psychologist, that can be a great step too. And then psychiatrists would be more if you're thinking potential medication for a student. Usually that's not going to be the place you start if you're just bringing up a conversation with a parent. So I don't know if that helps out. Other questions? I can tell y'all are in the thick of this. Yeah.
So you said basically students will feed off of the calm or the atmosphere or our own understanding of our mental calmness. And so when we have anxious students in the classroom, to what extent are they affecting other students? Is this heightened anxiety in effect because now we're more aware of anxiety in teens? Or, I mean, it's not contagious, but is it?
Yeah, so to what extent does the environment of other kids around the kid impact their anxiety? Thinking about our own impact of our mental well-being. Great question. Is it contagious or isn't it? I would say yes, it's contagious. I think there's lots of research showing that mental wellness is very contagious. So people who hang out with happy people are happier. People who hang out with anxious people are more anxious. People who hang out with angry people are more angry. So we absorb emotion from each other. Now, that doesn't mean we try to create perfect little bubbles around ourselves. But I heard a speaker last week talk about how we do have to curate our social experience. This is how he described it. So to recognize that there's benefit to noticing who are we around and how are they impacting our well-being. Now, you don't have the luxury of saying, I'm just going to have the happy, non-anxious children in my classroom, right? I know. Oddly. And so what that means is that you just want to be thinking actively then about how to create safe spaces and bubbles within that group of children. I know that some kids really soak up anxiety from even misbehavior going on around them. Others seem able to kind of do their own thing a little bit more. So I think there are different levels of contagion for different kids. But sometimes even for other kids in a classroom, you know, it's helpful to sometimes be speaking to the whole class about things like anxiety or mindfulness or wellness. And also to be recognizing when a child is really struggling, does need to be brought aside to work through that a little bit more directly. So good question. So it's 3:15. Thank you so much for your kind attention.